final part of today's lecture then, and we will come to Singing in the Rain. Possibly Gwyneth Paltrow if we have time, but we may not have time. So, Bette Davis was unusual to some extent in that she was acclaimed as a great actor. She was known for her acting talent, and her talent as an actress was very visible on the screen. A lot of the parts she played were strategically designed to showcase acting in one way or another, often by having her play an actress on the screen, such as in Dangerous and in All About Eve, and to some extent in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane as well. But that's unusual. For most stars, they're not necessarily known as great actors. And in fact, some of Hollywood's greatest actors are not really stars. They're usually talked about as character actors. And someone who's written about this is Barry King in his essay, Stardom as an Occupation, which is included in Paul Kerr's book, Hollywood Film Industry, from 1986. So Barry King's Stardom as an Occupation. And in this book, he points out that star actors are different from other actors. He says that what is particular about the star is that he or she is not so much an actor in the sense of defined above, forget that bit, but a self or personality that behaves. To say that a star behaves doesn't mean that they're themselves, but rather that stars don't, as it were, surrender their public personality to the demands of characterization. And what he's talking about here is actors are really, in his definition, those performers who become subsumed by their character. They go into their character, and as we watch them on the film, we're not really aware of them as a star. We're convinced by the character they're playing. Whereas stars do something different. A star is always ultimately themselves. So, for instance, in any film featuring Cary Grant, we're always aware he's Cary Grant. Whatever his character, whoever his character is always recognisable as Cary Grant. He always looks like Cary Grant, the way Cary Grant looks in all his publicity material, and his characters always behave with the mannerisms of Cary Grant. So that's what distinguishes a star from a character actor. The character actor changes and adapts and becomes invisible with each different role they play. The star remains always themselves. Tom Cruise is always Tom Cruise. Cary Grant is always Cary Grant. Judy Garland is always Judy Garland in all her characters. We never forget that. And even Bette Davis is always Bette Davis, however well she's performing in that role. So Barry King adds that stars do not function as actors. Okay, this doesn't mean necessarily that a given star can't act. Clearly a lot of these stars, Tom Cruise, Bette Davis, Cary Grant, they all act. They're all very accomplished actors. But acting is not essential to stardom. He goes on to say that professional judgment regards character actors as representing the peak of the skill hierarchy as far as acting is concerned. So whereas stars are at the peak, albeit short-term on average, of the reward hierarchy. So stars get paid more than character actors, but character actors are genuinely considered to be the better actors in the movie. And we can see this in the case of Singing in the Rain. So the stars, in terms of the film, in terms of the diegesis and the fiction, the stars in the film are Lena Lamont, played by Jean Hagen, and Dan Lockwood, Gene Kelly. But neither of them is supposed to be a good actor. We know quite clearly, poor old Lena Lamont can't act to save her life. She just looks good, and she just looks glamorous. She can't sing, she can't talk. There's very little demonstration in the film that in those silent films she's making, she can act competently. And even Gene Kelly eventually admits to Debbie Reynolds that he's not a very, to Kathy, that he's not a very good actor. He's a good dancer, but he's not a very good actor. Meanwhile, the stars of the film are Gene Kelly, who's the main star of the film, Donald O'Connor, his co-star, and young Debbie Reynolds, an up-and-coming star at MGM in 1952. And the film is, of course, a showcase for their talents as dancers and singers. You know, the magical moments of the film are where Gene Kelly is performing either on his own or with Donald O'Connor or with Debbie Reynolds. Or there is also a marvellous moment where Donald O'Connor performs Be a Clown. Is it Be a Clown? He performs? Is that his musical number? Make 'em Laugh. Make 'em Laugh, sorry. However, interestingly, the only one of these actors from Singing in the Rain to be nominated for an Oscar in 1953 was Gene Hagen, who plays Lena Lamont, the star who supposedly can't act. She was nominated for the Best Actress in a Supporting Role award. So none of the other actors were up for Oscars, only Gene Hagen. Gene Hagen plays Lena Lamont in Singing in the Rain. Prior to making this film, she'd studied drama at the Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, on the East Coast, Northeast Coast of America. Thereafter, Hagen made her film debut in a comedy starring Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy called Adam's Rib and directed by prestige director George Cukor in 1949. She then went on to support Marilyn Monroe, who was co-starring with Sterling Hayden in John Huston's film, The Asphalt Jungle. If you haven't got the point from here, Gene Hagen was nothing remotely like the character she was playing in the film. She doesn't talk remotely like. And in fact, in the final sequence where you hear Lena Lamont performing the song with Debbie Reynolds singing behind her, the voice you're hearing is actually Gene Hagen's own voice, not Debbie Reynolds' voice. So that voice, that lovely, deep, rich, sonorous voice, is actually Gene Hagen's voice. That high-pitched, funny voice she uses all the way through the film is just a voice she's putting on for the film. Sure, we can all talk, don't we? Okay, sorry, dreadful. So, of course, Gene Kelly was the main star and the main driving force behind this film. Not only was he the main star of the three headlining acts whose name appear above the title, but he was also the co-director. And in fact, he was being very generous here because he was not only sharing star billing with Donald O'Connor and Debbie Reynolds, by rights he should have just been the star of the film, but he also shared co-directing rights because actually Stanley Donen, who gets the co-writing, the co-directing credit, was really a choreographer and he wasn't really that much involved with the actual direction of the film. He was involved in the staging of the musical numbers. So it was really directed by Gene Kelly. Now, as I mentioned to you the other day, Gene Kelly was originally hired by MGM in 1941, 11 years before he makes Singing in the Rain, after he had a career first as a dance teacher in New York and then as a dancer on Broadway, achieving major hit with the Broadway musical Pal Joey in 1940. He made his film debut supporting Judy Garland in For Me and My Girl, 1942, after which he was loaned out to Columbia to support Rita Hayworth in her musical Cover Girl. He then started to appear in a string of what we might now consider to be Gene Kelly musicals. He was nominated for an Oscar for the first time for his leading role in Anchors Away in 1945, in which he co-starred with Frank Sinatra. He then co-starred again with Judy Garland in The Pirate, directed by her husband Vincente Minnelli, 1948, but this flopped at the box office. He then co-directed for the first time and starred in On the Town, again with Sinatra, which was another spectacularly successful film at the box office. He then co-starred again with Judy Garland as a way of helping to prop up her ailing career in 1950 And although they both have their names above the title, it was really a Gene Kelly movie. He then starred in American in Paris, again directed by Garland's husband, Vincente Minnelli, this time starring with a newcomer, a French actress and dancer called Leslie Caron. And this film went on to win 6 Oscars. Not for Kelly himself, but for other categories. But it was a massively successful, it was the Oscar-winning film of that year. Kelly, though, was nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance in American in Paris. Although he shares the limelight with his colleagues Debbie Reynolds and Donald O'Connor, I think it's very self-evident from the film, if you've seen the film, and of course most of you hopefully have, that what we're watching is a Gene Kelly musical. It's a Gene Kelly star vehicle. He is the man of the show, at the whole heart of the show. And in fact, you know, the biggest dance number is the title number from the show, which is just Gene Kelly performing by himself in the rain. Okay. Okay. Just going back to Barry King and his definition of stars and character actors. So, I mean, what's interesting about Singing in the Rain is the stars of the show are not the greatest actors in the show. The greatest actor, the one who's acclaimed for their acting, is actually in a supporting role playing the character actor's part of Lena Lamont, Jean Hagen. That was the key point that I really wanted to make about that film. Barry King writes in his article, Stardom as an Occupation, that to the extent that the star is, unlike other actors, the bearer of a meaning that transcends the plotted meaning, then the star can function as a marker of quality, a meta-meaning, something beyond the actual narrative or story of the film itself that survives particular embodiments. In other words, the star can circulate without necessarily losing their quality of being a distinct property. Okay. He then goes, he's mainly talking about stars, how stars function in Hollywood compared to character actors in the studio system. But in a later essay that appears in Thomas Austin and Martin Barker's book, Contemporary Hollywood Cinema, he reworks some of these ideas when he comes to think about the distinctive nature of contemporary Hollywood and how stardom and character acting function in Hollywood of the late 90s and early 2000s. And here King notes that in contemporary Hollywood, stars construct multiple and ever-changing identities, rendering them indeterminate and essentially performative, rather than enabling their fans to interpret, understand, and/or use them according to their own desires and concerns. And what he's interested in investigating in this essay is how stars don't necessarily have the consistency of a star persona in the way that Cary Grant did, or Gene Kelly did, or Judy Garland did during the studio era. But more and more contemporary stars, like Tom Cruise and like Brad Pitt and like George Clooney, have very different sets of identities that they can assume for different types of film, for different types of audience. So they can start to literally be different things for different audiences. So today's stars, he says, are discursively challenged in their efforts to meld all the practices undertaken in their name into a coherent commercial identity. Stars' identities are now manufactured and maintained by a series of specialists who undertake responsibility for various and distinguishing aspects of their public profile, engagement, and interaction. And he says, more or less what I was just saying to you, that stars now have a wardrobe of identities connected to a product stream. And in fact, something he talks about very interestingly is how all contemporary stars now have to have a franchise. You know, Tom Cruise has got Mission Impossible and he's now developing Jack Reacher as his other franchise. But all major stars have to be part of a franchise. And that basically means they have one identity that connects to that franchise. Meanwhile, they all need a cult identity. They all need to make these other smaller budget independent movies or films that are marketed as independent, where they have more of a cult or marginal following. Okay, and so basically they're playing with different identities at different points. And I think these images of Brad Pitt illustrates the point for us. There's something here that is quintessentially Brad Pitt that we can recognise, that registers for us if we know anything about Brad Pitt, as Brad Pitt. But you can see they're all quite different incarnations of Brad Pitt. There's the kind of hippie, bohemian, edgy, culty, indie Brad Pitt. And there's the more serious statesman-like, George Clooney-like, George Clooney wannabe-like Brad Pitt. And then the... I'll use that one again. You know, or there's the kind of business professional, you know, or there's the holding on to his youth Brad Pitt. So, you know, there are different Brad Pitts now. So rather than talking about in Richard Dyer terms that stars have structured polysemy, that they are one thing that means different things to different audiences, now stars are actually promoting themselves as different things, different forms of themselves, two different audiences, which is a different process. And the reason for this is that stars now are not the property of a studio. They are a property of themselves. They're involved in their own making of stardom. They're independent, or, as Barry King says, they are stakeholders in their own identity. So stars are now no longer employees of the studios, but rather, as he says, stakeholders in the enterprise that manages their careers. You know, they're shareholders in their brand and in their companies. Yet the star as entrepreneur must be ready to switch roles as business opportunities arise. So as one project comes up, which might be a lucrative HBO series, they need to switch to accommodate that and change their image and identity to work for that project. And then maybe they need to switch to become part of a big multi-star franchise. And then, you know, maybe for an indie movie, they've got to switch again. So they need flexibility and adaptability like never before in the contemporary marketplace. The globalization also of the market for the star services exacerbates this process, because claims of existential commitment, multiply as films and products open in different markets and address cultural constituencies. So the other thing is, stardom now is not only global but multicultural. So stars have to function in lots of different marketplaces around the world and to different social groups around the world. So again, they have to be adaptable. So when they appear in India, for instance, they have to have images that accommodate to an Indian market. When their images and films circulate within China, they need to be sympathetic and adaptable to the domestic context in which they're appearing. And of course, they're not only appearing in terms of their films, but as we know, they're also appearing live on domestic TV shows, the same format type TV show that we get all around the world. I'm sure you have it here in the Czech Republic. You'll have some kind of witty TV anchor person who presents on the couch on a Friday evening just before the weekend, or on a Saturday evening. A host of stars who are all promoting their latest films or whatever the latest product is. Okay, so, and they've got to adapt their identities to fit into that vehicle. So King is describing a process now in which actors are involved in the writing of their own stardom. And so he talks about this notion of autographic stardom, basically self-writing. He notes the constant rewriting of star persona as former identities are maintained in some roles and films alongside newly invented ones. So not only now a star's going through the process that Tom Cruise has gone through since the 80s of changing and then kind of casting off one skin like a snake. I don't mean to call Tom Cruise a snake, but you know, perhaps I do. You know, cast off one skin, become something, and then cast off that skin. Become what stars are now having to do in the new millennium is wear these different coats, these different identities, put them away in the wardrobe, and then fetch them out again. So you don't permanently cast off a skin anymore, because you have to put it back on again, you know, for working in different contexts. So the whole thing is becoming increasingly more complex and possibly more interesting. And so he says, stars today seem permanently resettling the terms of their representation, and this equivocation becomes their story. And again, what we're getting are stars whose images and their identities and the kind of films they make are no longer as stable as they used to be. You know, we're getting used to very surprising vehicles. The stars begin to appear in things where you'd least expect them to be. So he says that stars are no longer there to be read by audiences differently, i.e. polysemic, as Dyer once described them back in 1979, but rather they produce themselves differently in order to be read differently, therefore playing a much more fundamental role in the process of interpretation, of course being aided all the time by their gang, their team of publicists, agents, managers, stylists, and everyone else, coaches, managers, saying the same thing over and over again, but big teams who they hire and they work with, just as Bette Davis did, but now all stars do it. She was unusual in hiring an independent team back in the 40s. Now all stars do it. It's the standard. So operating then in a fragmented, highly competitive, intensely scrutinized, highly commodified, and global market, the new generation of successful entrepreneurial stars are forced to manage their persona by stretching an apparent core of personal qualities to cover all contingencies and rationalizing every shift and change as an aspect of constancy. So basically, all stars, what he's trying to fathom, what he's interested in here, I'm not sure he's quite got it, but it's interesting, you know, to find a language to explain how stars constantly transmogrify and transform, transmutate in front of our eyes as they keep moving from project to project, then kind of go back again to something we recognise and are familiar with, and then suddenly evolve into something else for a while, and then go back again to a core of what we identify with. He's basically describing some kind of elastic personality that stretches and moulds and reforms and comes back, rather than the old plastic form, which is something that was synthetic, it was constructed, it was created by a team of people, but essentially it was stable, and it would only shift very slowly, almost infinitesimally, over time and transform into something else. Now, stars are stretching and moving and all the time becoming very unstable forces, hence elastic rather than plastic. Okay. So I think Barry King's recent work on film stars and stardom represents a theoretical elaboration upon Richard Dyer's work. It marks a departure, but it also goes back to some of those core principles of Richard Dyer's work, and it's one that embraces the peculiar economic dynamics of the film industry far more forcefully, while responding to the contemporary changes that have been happening in the film industry since the late 1990s. And that's as far as I want to go with that. Now, unfortunately, I haven't time to really go through the Gwyneth Paltrow piece. But as I know some of you like Gwyneth Paltrow, shall I just jump in there and do a bit of Gwyneth Paltrow? The other thing I wanted to draw to your attention, and this is something, this PowerPoint slide, these will be available to you, and you can check this out. You can see how we lead up to this. But there's another piece of work that I think is really interesting in terms of understanding contemporary stardom. And this was produced by Christine Geraghty in 2000 in a book called Reinventing Film Studies by Christine Gledhill and Linda Williams. And she has an essay in there called Reexamining Stardom, Questions of Texts, Bodies and Voices and Performance. And although I didn't put it on the reading list for this course, it is well worth having a look at. I think for those of you who want to go forward with studies of stardom, it's a really good way of conceptualizing different types of contemporary star. She basically has identified the fact that there are now three different major different types of stars operating in contemporary Hollywood. Stars who are celebrity stars, stars who are professionals, and stars who are performers, a bit like Betty Davis, one of the more actorly stars, whose reputation rests on their ability to act well and produce Oscar-worthy films. So all of these are determined by the relative exposure the stars receive in terms of their off-screen or non-professional life, and also the degree to which their acting skills are showcased in their publicity material. So, three kinds of film star. The celebrity film star, like Brad Pitt, film stars whose personal life circulates widely and in the greatest detail. You know, we know every single thing that happens in the life of Brad Pitt and his associated female and children. Professional stars, though, are film stars we don't really know very much about in terms of their professional life, but nevertheless, they maintain a consistent public attention through their ongoing work in either film or television or other media. And they're known to be dedicated to their work. They might not be the greatest actors on the planet, but they approach their projects in a highly professional way. And then there are those actors who are famous for acting, for their ability to act and for taking acting characterization seriously. Actors like Meryl Streep and Dustin Hoffman, who are defined largely in terms of their work rather than their private life, and are known for playing a wide selection of different characters. So celebrity stars. In the 1990s, the relative slowness of film production and the inevitable long gaps between the release of one star vehicle and another prompted many actors to take work in other media like television, theatre and advertising in order to maintain a continuous public profile. This gave them a high celebrity status. So because if you were under contract to Warner Brothers or MGM in the 1930s and you were doing well, they'd stick you in five films a year. Those films would be on release for about 2 months. And so your film was always out there. You were always in the public arena. Now, the contemporary cinema, the way the industry works is different. As a major star, you might only make one film a year. And that film may take 2 years to complete. Big, spectacular blockbuster. Think about Daniel Craig making the next James Bond movie. You know, he's not going to make five James Bond films a year. How often do we get them? So, and in between, he'll make some other things, but he's mainly committed to his franchise, the James Bond film. So often we don't see him. He's not around. He's not in the public arena. So in order to keep his profile going, he needs to do other stuff, such as advertising or television or maybe some theatre work. Then there's our professional stars. Other stars have worked exclusively in film. They take roles in a wide variety of genre while avoiding the celebrity spotlight. These stars are those who appear in different genres, but they nevertheless retain high levels of consistency in terms of their own performance. They have a recognisable signature style of acting or regular idiolect. And in that way, they're able to maintain the promise of a reliably specific set of pleasures, particularly when viewers choose films from the comprehensive selection that's available to them in video stores. So if we go into a video store, we like Denzel Washington films, we like nearly everything he's been in, we're likely to take his film off the shelf. So Denzel Washington, I think, is a very, very good example of an actor now who is major, major box office. His last film has just broken box office records, and yet he's not really a celebrity star. We don't read much about him the rest of the time. But, you know, he's kind of working at a low-level pace, but he's bankable. He's hugely bankable. Then we've still got a whole generation of star performers. Dustin Hoffman's still going, Robert De Niro's still going, Meryl Streep's still going, and they're now joined by actors such as Michael Sheen, who disappears pretty much into his roles. We don't know a lot about who is Michael Sheen, what is his personal life, who knows? Daniel Day-Lewis, we don't know a lot about him. They kind of disappear into the roles that they play, into the characters they play. So they're star performers. Okay, dear old Gwyneth, where does Gwyneth, how does she fit into this? Well, at first sight, she would appear to be a celebrity star. She came to fame around the time she was having an affair with Brad Pitt, another celebrity star. And this relationship became highly covered in all the celebrity magazines. She also appeared in a whole host of magazines throughout the 1990s, Vogue, Cosmopolitan, Elle, Marie Claire, and many others besides. So she's done a lot of work in terms of advertising, modelling, and all of that kind of stuff. So at that level, she's a major celebrity. And in fact, she probably appears more on magazines than she appears in films. You know, how many films does she make a year? Nevertheless, she could also be considered as a performer. She's the daughter of an acclaimed stage actress, Blythe Danner. You may know her mother from the Fockers franchise, Meet the Parents, Meet the Fockers, Little Fockers, etc. She plays Robert De Niro's wife in that. But prior to that, she was a major award-winning Broadway actress. It meant that Gwyneth grew up around actors and around acting. Her breakthrough role was in the British film Emma, which was an adaptation of a classic English literary novel by Jane Austen, so literary project. Her next major role was in Shakespeare in Love, which showcased her acting skills alongside Judi Dench, one of England's greatest, most acclaimed actresses, as well as her appearances in the Bond films up until recently. And as an American actress, she had the challenge of performing in an English accent alongside English actors. That's a tough thing to do, and she pulled it off convincingly. She then went on to turn down leading roles in James Cameron's Titanic in order to do low-budget films that she considered more creative, more interesting, like Sliding Doors, Shallow Hal, and the Wes Anderson film, The Royal Tenenbaums. Not as big box office, but had credibility. So she's a star with credibility. She's gone on in the early 2000s to do a lot of literary projects, including Possession, Sylvia, which she plays the suicidal poet Sylvia Plath. And she's also appeared on stage at the London's Dolmar Warehouse in the play Proof, which she then appeared in the film 3 years later, opposite Anthony Hopkins, another kind of great English character actor. Of course, she's found her foot in a franchise. She's now in the very successful Iron Man franchise and also in the Avengers franchise. So she, like most contemporary stars, she has a franchise profile. But the films she seems to relish doing are either more literary or theatrical, and that places squarely into the star as performer category. So I think Gwyneth Paltrow is really interesting because part of this elastic personality that Barry King's talking about makes her difficult to quantify because she's more than one thing. On the one hand, as Karen Hollinger says, she is a would-be actress concealed under this conventional movie star exterior, or as I say in the Star Studies book, that beneath the surface of a star as celebrity, we can find a star as performer. So, but she's also got that professional dimension as well, I think, through her franchise. So she's very hard to pin down. And the reason I think now she's hard to pin down, and what makes her representative as a female, a young female in contemporary cinema, is this elastic personality. Basically what she's got is what Barry King calls a wardrobe of personalities. She can take different identities out of the wardrobe according to the project she's putting herself up for. And that's how she succeeds and carves out a lucrative career in the film business at the current time. And I think that's what all major actresses have to do. Nicole Kidman's doing exactly the same thing. Okay, that's it for today. Tomorrow, I'm going to be looking finally at how stars have been used to embody national and historical characteristics. Okay, we'll look a little bit more at Shah Rukh Khan, and a little bit more at Brigitte Bardot, and a few more comments, I think, about Marilyn Monroe. Okay.